Adina, you're a young Muslim American who was born in Montenegro, and you came to the United States with your family when you were a baby. One of the things you have said is that when you were growing up, you felt stuck between cultures, and that one of your struggles has been to figure out which part of you was Montenegrin, which part of you was Muslim, and which part of you was American. Can you talk about that struggle?
Sure. I think that that struggle stayed with me from when I was a little girl up until I was in college, really. I think the main things that really plagued me were, because I came from a non-practicing Muslim family, I mean, I was born Muslim, but my parents grew up in under a communist/socialist, dictatorship. And so religion was really kind of squashed during while they were growing up. And so my parents didn't know much about Islam growing up except for, sort of the fundamentals. And that was what they passed on to my sister and me. And so growing up, I knew, for example, I mean, I could think to call it to high school specifically, I knew that I wasn't allowed to date. I knew that I wasn't allowed to drink. I knew all these things that I wasn't allowed to do, but I couldn't really figure out whether that was because of, my Montenegrin culture that frowned upon it, or whether it was my family's Islamic faith that frowned upon it. And so looking at some of those issues and how they impacted me growing up, I struggled a lot with my parents and trying to have that conversation with them. And it was kind of blurry for me for a really long time. It was only when I went to college and, like many other college students, sort of went on my own, journey to figure out who I am and what matters to me and what my faith is and all of that kind of thing, that I, started to read and read about my faith, read about my culture, and seek more information, that I was able to sort of, assign things into different columns. I was able to assign, a certain cultural practices or traditions and in one column and the religious ones in another column. And ultimately, as I went through that journey and trying to parse that out, I felt more comfortable with the intersection of the two. But that has been a lifelong journey for me, and I'm sure for many other people who grow up as a child of immigrant parents, who are doing the best that they can, but trying to figure out how all these things fit together has certainly been one of the biggest challenges of my life.
One of the things that you do as part of your faith is you wear a headscarf as a young Muslim American, hijab. And you've said that you often get questions from strangers. You could be at the grocery store, you could be at the shopping mall, and people come up and say to you, "Why do you wear that thing on your head?" So tell us what you say to those people, but then also the larger question of your decision to cover and for you what that signifies.
Sure. Well, I remember the first day that I wore a headscarf. I was a sophomore in college, and I was walking down the street at at UCLA in our little Westwood college town, and was heading towards the store, and I saw this older woman walking towards me, and she was looking at me so intently that I figured she must recognize me, and I felt terrible that I didn't recognize her as well. Well, she made a beeline straight for me and came up, and I sort of went, "Well, hello," and sort of faked knowing her because I felt a little uncomfortable. And then she put her hand on her shoulder and she said, "Honey, you're in America now. You don't have to wear that here."
Wow.
And I just had this moment where where my heart and my stomach just sunk into my shoes.
Oh.
And that was day one, and I really didn't know what to say at the moment. I think I sort of stopped and was a little stunned, and then fired back at her, I'm an American. I know that. Thank you very much. I made the choice on my own or something along those lines.
Yeah.
I really don't know if I even made sense. I was so caught off guard. And that question in one form or another has certainly cropped up over the years. I'm 32 now, so it's been, 13 years since I first started wearing a headscarf. And the decision for me in the beginning was about wanting to represent a different kind of Muslim woman. I described what it was like for me growing up. I really didn't grow up in a Muslim community. I grew up with my family. I didn't really, we weren't really practicing. We didn't really go to mosque very often. So I didn't have the benefit of having Muslim peers and being able to understand Islam as it was practiced. So when I went to college and first had that experience, I was forced to reconsider a lot of the stereotypes that I had myself about Islam and that I had about Muslim women and what the hijab or the headscarf was all about. And when I finally took the step of reading the Quran, you know, beginning to end on my own, I was frankly surprised that the Quran was actually not even a document that tolerated women, but embraced the position of women as equal partners within society, and you know, an equal in the eyes of God, and that for me, that reading and that revelation, that you know, that what I had thought because of what I had seen on television and in films and you know, in other places, wasn't accurate. It angered me, to be honest. And in that process, I thought to myself, well, you know, I am a European, you know, European-looking young woman, and for all intents and purposes, nobody would really recognize the fact that I am, you know, quote-unquote, you know, that I'm quote-unquote Muslim, you know, mm-hmm. that I don't look the part for, you know. And so in my 19-year-old mind, I thought to myself, well, there, rather than simply, you know, talking the talk, I wanted to walk the walk and represent, you know, an accurate picture of what a Muslim woman is all about, that I can be career driven and I can be successful and outspoken and intelligent and all of those things, because that was the exact picture of Muslim women that I saw all around me, but that other people didn't have the benefit of seeing. And so the decision for me was about wanting to represent what I think the hijab is about, which is that a woman should be taken for her mind, for her intellect, for what, you know, what her contributions to the world, rather than for her, you know, just for her body or for superficial reasons. And so the symbolism of the hijab as a tool of modesty, a tool of equality, a tool of empowerment, really, was very powerful for me. And that's what led to my decision to start wearing it. I think in the 13 years that have passed, every year I feel a little differently about it. It's, you know, it has, I think in the beginning it felt like an honor and a privilege, and then for a while it felt like a responsibility and a burden, and then for a while it felt like it was the thing that was robbing me of my anonymity. And then for a while it became a conversation starter, and one that I embraced. And then for another period of time it became just another piece of clothing. I mean, just a piece, you know. Sure. And so I think that for every Muslim woman, your relationship with your hijab, if you wear one, evolves over time. I have learned to not fight that, but to know that just as, you know, you go through different stages of life and there are feelings that accompany each of those, so too it is with wearing a headscarf. And I have over the years worn it in different ways, and you know, as an expression of sort of where I'm at that point in my life. So it's a big factor in my life, but not because I make it that. It's because other people make it that.
Wow, that's a great answer, and I think you're right. That does upend a lot of stereotypes. So thank you for that. I want to ask you now about your job. And what you do now is you currently work as the communications director of the Muslim Public Affairs Council in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And what you say is you call yourself a translator between Muslims and mainstream journalists. What do you mean by that? And could you just talk about your job a little bit, what some of the challenges of your job are and what some of your successes have been, too?
Sure. Well, the reason that I call myself a translator is because I was actually a journalist before I was a communications director, and so I have sort of seen both sides of how it works, both feeding into the news cycle and also trying to, you know, to feed the news news
sure.
cycle from the outside.
Sure.
And so I wanted to be a journalist from the time that I was 8 years old. I fell in love with Peter Jennings very quickly, sitting on my father's lap and watching the evening news with him every night. And that was something that stuck with me, up until my adulthood. And so I studied journalism and wanted to pursue a career in journalism, in broadcast journalism, actually. I sort of hit a speed bump after I graduated from college and started to interview for different jobs, and realized that wearing a headscarf and being in front of a camera as a news reporter didn't really go hand in hand for a lot of the producers and hiring directors that I was talking to. And so I sort of started to reassess where I was at. And I served first as a managing editor for a Muslim American magazine called The Minaret for a few years, thinking that I could bring together my passion for journalism and also my interest and passion for Islam and Muslim American activism and advancement in political and social issues. And so that was sort of the stepping stone, and that's what caused me to then start my master's degree in communication. And that became the step that made me think about the need for more translators, that so much of the coverage about Islam and Muslims is one-dimensional, maybe two-dimensional at best, and unbalanced in the sense of, on an individual basis, I think that most reporters strive for balance in their individual stories. But when we look at the collection of stories that's out there and the collection of coverage that's out there about Muslims and about Islam, it's lopsided. The coverage is extremely lopsided to cover the exception to Muslims worldwide rather than the majority of Muslims worldwide. And so I have sort of, you know, slowly taken it upon myself, not to necessarily correct that, but to try to eat away at that a little bit and to add to getting better stories told in the broadest sense possible. So my job comes down to a couple of main functions. In my media relations role, I get calls and make calls to reporters and producers almost on a daily basis. And half the time when I get calls, it's because, whatever reporter wants to get a comment from somebody in my organization about sociopolitical issues, international news events, violent extremism, you name it. And so, you know, we certainly fill that role and try to add to the public understanding and the public discourse and the policy discourse specifically about those issues, because they are shaping, you know, how our country is developing, really, particularly post 9/11. But the other half of the time, I get calls from reporters who are looking for good sources. They're, you know, I'm just a mediator, and sometimes I sort of think of myself as a dating service. You know, I get a call from...
And you're a matchmaker.
Yeah, exactly. I'm precisely a matchmaker. Yeah, I remember a time when I got a call from a reporter who was looking for specifically an Iraqi refugee family who had come from Iraq after the war started. Hopefully they were going to be two parents who were still together.
Oh my
and
gosh.
Their children. Yeah.
So a that boy, they could get a girl.
Exactly.
A dog.
Exactly. Hopefully they were on the Western seaboard so that it fell within the coverage zone of the newspaper.
Right.
So that, you know, and so then what I spend my time doing then is going back into my Rolodex and thinking, you know, going back and talking to community leaders and trying to identify people who sort of fit the bill, first of all. And then second of all, I spend a lot of time convincing those people to be willing to talk to reporters and producers. So it's extremely challenging in that sense, because I think that, you know, even when I do find good sources within my community, and those are precisely the kinds of stories that I want to get out there, is Muslims talking for themselves, about what matters to them. And
sure.
Their voices are so often invisible or drowned out in all of the shouting and the hysteria and the fear that that frequently takes over the news cycle when it comes to Islam and Muslims. But the challenge is that particularly for many recent immigrants, in this country, there is sort of a hesitation and a fear of their own in terms of talking to reporters and being misquoted or being misrepresented or just being, you know, contributing to the stereotype. So it's extremely challenging, and I've learned that this translator role, I originally saw it as being a translator for journalists. I also realize now that I'm a translator for Muslim Americans to have a more three-dimensional understanding themselves about, you know, what they call the media. And I'm always going around saying there's no such thing as the media, just like there is no such thing as the Muslims. you know, every outlet has its own and its own particular quirks, and you've got to give every reporter a chance before you judge them. So it's an extremely, extremely challenging job, but at the same time, one that I find really worthwhile because it's so current, it's so relevant, and without translators out there, I think that we would be in a, you know, even worse situation than we are currently in terms of trying to understand some of the biggest issues of our day that that impact Muslim Americans as well as other Americans.
One of the things you were just talking about now is stereotyped portrayals that are one-dimensional and don't really reflect the diversity or the authenticity of the Muslim American community. Can you talk about that complaint? Because certainly it is a complaint within a number of communities, not just the Muslim American community, about stereotyped portrayals. And do you think things are getting better, are getting worse? And again, you know, we don't want to just say the media here. So we would be talking about news. We'd be talking about popular culture as well. So that would be films and TV. And so just your assessment of whether things are getting better or worse in those various strains. And then how do you go about getting more authentic and better portrayals? You sort of answered that question a minute ago by talking about what you were doing in terms of the news cycle. But in terms of entertainment TV, what are some strategies?
Okay, so let's start with the first question, which is, I think that things are incrementally getting better. I always tell people I'm rarely accused of being an optimist, but I do think that things are slightly getting better because, you know, what 9/11 did was create a crisis and then create an opportunity for greater understanding, and I think that it created a level of curiosity, particularly within the entertainment industry and also the news industry, about this affected population, and they both realized that there were some interesting stories that they weren't getting, from or about our community and about our faith. Now, I think that, I want to focus on the entertainment industry because I think that what's happening there is really interesting. I think that post 9/11, that we initially expected, frankly, that the portrayals were going to get worse before they got better.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that by and large, Hollywood, both television production companies as well as filmmakers, stayed silent on terrorism-related plots and storylines for a few years until they sort of found a way to deal with it sort of sensitively and also intelligently. So there's good examples and there's bad examples. I think that some of the worst examples were initially things like that infamous, I think it was the second season of 24 on Fox, where the plot line focused around a quote-unquote sleeper cell family that was, obviously Muslim, and to the extent where the plot line included, I think the father or the mother ordering their child to kill or get rid of their boyfriend or girlfriend because they knew too much, or that kind of thing, and that. And I should say the billboards that accompanied that season of the storyline were ominous and fear-mongering. I think they said something like, could the sleeper cell live next door to you? Or some reference how can you trust your neighbors,
right,
or this person might be next door to you? And that we found extremely troubling for very obvious reasons. And as an example of how we deal with both bad portrayals and trying to get better portrayals, we immediately reached out to the executive producer of 24, Howard Gordon, as well as the diversity development department at Fox Television, and they were extremely receptive to meeting with us initially. They didn't fully understand what we were so up in arms about, but that initial meeting where we were able to lay out our concerns, talk about why this was so troubling, share the outrage and the hurt within our community to be portrayed this way, particularly when it's not somewhere overseas, it's right here in LA,
right.
And the suggestion that, you know, that we should be fearful of our neighbors really got to the core of that post 9/11 fear.
Mm-hmm.
And so what has come out of that, initially during that season, the producers agreed to run a PSA featuring Kiefer Sutherland, who's the star of the show, basically making clear this is a fictional plot line and, you know, a positive message about the contributions of Muslim American society and something along those lines. And later on down the road, they also added positive or neutral Muslim characters during that season and also subsequent seasons.
Mm-hmm.
What I think, you know, out of that crisis and that bad story, you know, really that,
right.
frankly, that bad
right.
plot
yeah.
that
yeah.
was created during the second season, the show has evolved tremendously, and to the point where, you know, as an example, Howard Gordon has since attended the Brookings Institution sponsored U.S. Muslim World Relations Forum in Doha, Qatar, a number of times, has engaged policymakers and think tanks about these issues, and has brought that back into how he deals with the show. And I think, you know, that's a real success story
wow.
to me.
Yeah.
Because we have, that relationship couldn't be more different today than it was when we started. And when we first had those meetings, you go in with realistic expectations, to be quite honest. But I think that the success that we've had in that situation, working with other groups as well, has really emboldened us and also made us realize that, really underscored the point that many people are making these mistakes not out of bad intentions or maliciousness, but because, you know, I mean, it makes for good television.
Sure.
They're easy plot lines to follow. There's always a good guy and a bad guy, but that ultimately they, you know, nobody wants to be held responsible for, you know, perpetuating stereotypes or, endangering any individuals or communities. We've since launched our Hollywood Bureau, where we proactively go out and engage the creative community. We go to industry functions all the time and let people know that we're here. We research upcoming film and television projects and reach out to producers and screenwriters to let them know that we're here not to ensure that positive stories are told, but that authentic stories are told, multidimensional stories are told, and that, you know, we're here to help you do it better. You know, we'll review scripts for accuracy and sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go onto the set and provide consultation so that we can ensure that, you know, the cultural and religious details are sort of, you know, they're done correctly so that we can promote the authenticity and the accuracy of what they're doing. And we've had a really good track record with that. We served as the Muslim consultant on that great groundbreaking CW show that was very short-lived, that was called Aliens in America.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done work with Saving Grace on TNT, with Bones on Fox, with Lie to Me on Fox, with there have been a number
wow.
of shows, with Prince of Persia for Disney, and I'm sure there are others that I'm forgetting. And then on top of that, I think that what we've realized ultimately about particularly Hollywood is that in addition to helping others get it right, that we really need to identify and promote talent from within our community. And this is what we get told by people in the industry all the time, is don't wait for other people to tell your story right. Get in there and do it yourself. You know,
mm-hmm.
nothing speaks like talent. And so we're really also trying to nurture and provide opportunities for aspiring Muslim artists, so that they can get their leg into the industry and hopefully, you know, be a success story down the road. We just had a really unique event with the legendary Debbie Allen, where, you know, we had a sit-down conversation with her in front of an audience, and I think one of the most touching things that about her story is how often, you know, she was able to just step in with her talent and let her talent lead, and, you know, and the issues of ethnicity were sort of in the background. She didn't, you know, she tried not to let that get to her.
Mm-hmm.
And the track record of success that she had that enabled her then to play a leading role in some of the defining television programs that feature, you know, that featured African American families and casts at their center, like A Different World and In the House and Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and, you know, and one after another. I mean, I think that's the kind of future that we're looking for, and I'm just waiting to see where, you know, where that Muslim American Spike Lee or Steven Spielberg is going to come from.
Wow, that's very exciting. That's really
exciting.
I
think so, too.
Yeah. I want to just flip back for a minute from entertainment back to news a little bit, especially given stories in the headlines these past few days, weeks, and months, starting with Fort Hood in November, and then other incidents since then of what some people are calling homegrown extremism or homegrown terrorism. And can you talk about how MPAC, your organization, is responding to these incidents?
Absolutely. You know, this, for obvious reasons, this is a dominant factor in our work on a day-to-day basis. And we try to walk that line with dealing with national security issues and also civil rights issues, because we think that they're equally important. I think that from our perspective, a lot of the troubling nature of these events is what it leads us to do as a nation in their aftermath. If we allow for the civil liberties and privacy protections to be eroded for Muslim Americans or you look at the recent TSA guidelines that are now targeting people from 14 countries, 13 of them being Muslim majority countries. If you allow that kind of selective enforcement to mm-hmm. take place against, one particular population, there is going to inevitably be a ripple out effect that will impact others. And I think right now many people feel that, we're just looking for the terrorists and these people, they're coming from these countries. But it's a slippery slope, and that's what we're particularly troubled by. So when it comes to incidents like the rash of incidents we've seen lately, we feel that we have a couple of responsibilities. The first is to clearly and vocally and unequivocally condemn these actions, because really it is, I can't tell you how horrifying it is as a Muslim to wake up to bad news and to be, have my stomach and my fist clenched just waiting to find out and thinking to mm-hmm. myself, please don't let it be a Muslim. Please don't let it be a Muslim. And then going through that, through this cycle of feeling then, not again. It's extremely sad and painful as a Muslim to watch these things happen and to know what a deep violation of my faith these kinds of actions or even attempted actions are. So we have a responsibility to educate the public and to make the public aware that that Muslims worldwide are condemning these actions, and we're just outraged and horrified by the events that we see taking place. And that secondly, that we have an opportunity and a responsibility to advise policymakers and law enforcement about how to do their jobs well. As Americans, we have that right and that responsibility. And one of the primary concerns these days for Muslim Americans is the degree to, or the tactics that law enforcement is employing in order to keep our country safe. Mm-hmm. We all share the concern about keeping our country safe, but the tactics shouldn't strip the rights of individuals. And specifically, I'm thinking of in the last year, there's been these rash of counterterrorism arrests. But on day one, they sound awful and they sound frightening, and then on day two and day three, we quickly learn, over and over again that there was some sort of paid informant involved. Mm-hmm. That more often than not, the paid informant was the one who proposed the idea for the alleged terror plot, and who was offering to supply the supplies that are needed, and that the people who were involved in these cases. It's up to the court of law to decide. When you look at how these cases are panning out, it seems like dim-witted individuals or petty criminals are sadly being entrapped. Mm-hmm. I leave it to the courts, but the facts on these cases leave a lot to be desired and haven't exactly won the confidence of Muslim American communities across the country, particularly when this issue of paid informants, particularly as they wander into American mosques, it creates a real chilling effect for Muslim Americans across the country who want to just go to their house of worship and worship freely. And feel that their religious freedom is being infringed upon because they feel like well, you know, is the white convert, quote unquote, next to me, really a convert, or is that an undercover agent who is trying to entrap me? It's a sad day when you go to your house of worship and you don't know whether to trust the person who's sitting next to you, or even, you know, to say hello to them, because you're not sure whether they are who they say they are. And I think that is not the place that we want to be in as a country. And again, that said, we law enforcement has a job to do, and we support that job, but doing it right and doing it well and effectively, it requires that there be a more intelligent and thoughtful approach that's being applied. Specifically, we just released a paper called Building Bridges to Strengthen America.
Yeah, can you talk about that? Sure.
Absolutely. And that, I mean, the reason that we've been working on this paper for, I would say the better part of the last 6 or 9 months. And we had two goals when we started the paper. The first was to analyze the theories that are out there about the process of radicalization, because so much has been said about it, and so much of it just doesn't carry water. And then the second part of the paper is to examine and make recommendations about the nature of the relationship between law enforcement and Muslim American communities. So on the first subject, that of radicalization, our author, who's our government liaison in Washington, D.C., his name is Alejandro Butel, he analyzes all the theories that are out there and essentially debunks them, because the reality is that there is no one process of radicalization. What we've learned, if anything, from this the rash of cases that we've looked at in recent years is that each case has its own intricacies, and that there are many lone wolves, as they've said, that are involved in these cases. And so the more that we try to spell out, a process, the more that we're leading ourselves to create blind spots that can undermine our own work in trying to keep our country safe. And so we really try to go about debunking the idea that there is a process of radicalization. And Alejandro puts it in the terms of, ultimately we believe in sort of a hybrid theory, which is, simply put, in different situations, the factors are different. And that's the bottom line. So, and then on the second part of the paper, we are trying to spell out the need for stronger engagement between Muslim American communities and federal and local law enforcement. But we make the point that our communities and our law enforcement need one another, but they also need to respect one another. And in order for there to be a effective relationship between law enforcement and Muslim American communities, there needs to be a separation of labor, separation of responsibilities. Law enforcement needs to focus on criminal behavior and not political speech or religious activity or any of these other factors which some have wrongly connected to criminal behavior, and that when it comes to ideological extremism or what some have called radicalization, I have my hesitation about using that word because it's really not so clearly defined.
Sure.
But when it comes to issues within our communities about extremism, it is our responsibility as Muslims to deal with those head on. Law enforcement should not serve as religious police. That is not where we want to go as a country. And so we really advocate for a separation of responsibilities and a greater degree of respect and trust building that needs to take place, because the kinds of tactics that that the FBI specifically has had in some of these cases really have undermined deeply the trust of Muslim American communities towards law enforcement, and that's counterproductive ultimately to what law enforcement is trying to do, which is keep us safe.
Right. I just have one last question for you, Anita. Thank you for all of this. It's really good information, as well as I think just good stuff for every good education, I'll say as well. But as you look ahead in the coming days, what challenges do you see facing Muslim American communities? What are some concerns you have, and then what gives you hope?
I think that our primary challenge is that of self-definition. in the years that I have been doing this work now, I've been an empath for about 5.5 years. And it's been an uphill battle, but what has really gotten my goat, to use a poor expression, is that over the years, that what I see when it comes to coverage and even policymakers looking at issues around our communities is that we the moderate, the mainstream, the proud Muslims have lost our control over our credibility and our authority on issues of religion and of our communities, and that we the ones who own our communities, who are proud of who we are and of our role in in our country, the United States, have to prove our religious credentials when the extremists, the hateful voices out there, they don't have to do that. I think the best example I can give for that is, I think that, Osama bin Laden can videotape a message in any cave in the world, and that message will get played ad nauseum, translated, analyzed, discussed on news stations all around the world, which to me is free propaganda, free recruiting, all mm-hmm. of that. Now, for a mainstream Muslim like myself, a simple videotaped message isn't going to go anywhere, first of all. Second of all, people like me are jumping up and down every single day to try to get the mainstream message and voice out there as much as possible. And yet, when we step forward to do that, we are the ones who have to prove our credibility and our credentials when it comes to religious and political issues. And I think that has robbed us of our ability to define ourselves. And so I think that in the coming days and years, our challenge and our mandate is to put forth and to advocate who we are on our own terms and to define ourselves. This makes me think of, I was just last week at a talk that Dr. Sherman Jackson, who is a professor of Islamic law and I believe Muslim studies at the University of Michigan, and he really he talked about the need for Muslim Americans to create and develop an indigenous American identity for themselves, an indigenous American racial identity for themselves, and that really struck a chord with me because it just confirms, my own experiences and my own feelings about these issues, because I think that that's really that's connected to the other challenge of what our young people in our communities are dealing with all around the country. One of the main the fallout from this spate of cases that we've dealt with, where now, questions are being asked about homegrown terrorism and all of that, is that that has the ability to cast further suspicion on young Muslim Americans who are struggling with their identity, who are trying to get a good education, who are trying to understand their faith and, live it to the best of their ability, and who are trying to be contributing members of society. And frankly, they're the best thing we've got. They're talented, they're passionate, they're engaged in community service and civic engagement. They want to be a part of the solution. They're working with people of all different backgrounds and faiths, and yet they are, in many ways, facing the exact same thing I faced the first day I put on hijab, and my nationality and my loyalty and my intelligence, were questioned.
Right.
That's the last thing that we want to do. And so I see the development and the evolution and the support of our young people as being our primary challenge, but also it's the very same thing that gives me the most hope, because what I see today is, 10 years ago when I was in college, it was very strange that I was going into journalism, because the only acceptable careers, for many of my Muslim peers were to go into medicine or engineering or business or fields like that that were, prominent, successful, and, fulfilled all of those assumptions. And what I've seen since 9/11 is law and the media have become the new medicine and engineering.
Uh-huh.
And that makes me really hopeful, because what I just imagine that 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, when these young people who are now studying these fields become a force in those industries and are able to from a place of authentic ownership and also of authentic interest and passion are able to contribute to those fields that we will define ourselves on a public stage. And I hope it doesn't take 10 years, but I'm really counting on the talent and the quantity of, you know, of young people who are spreading out to new and interesting fields and are taking ownership over their identity and of their country. And the possibilities that will take us to are the thing that make me the most hopeful.
Well, that's very good news. That makes me hopeful, too. is there anything else you'd like to say, Adina, that I haven't covered?
I think we've covered a lot of territory.
Well, great. You were just you were terrific. And thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.